Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Where to Go, your personal guide to the world's best travel destinations. If you haven't listened before, I'm James Atkinson, online brand manager at DK Eyewitness.
And I'm Lucy Richards, senior editor at DK Eyewitness.
Today we're doing something a little bit different, actually. We're talking all things slow travel and journeys with DK Eyewitness project editor Becky Flynn and travel writer Shafiq Medji. So hi to Shafiq and Becky. Hello.
Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for inviting us.
So Becky and Shafiq have both been working on the new DK Eyewitness book, Unforgettable Journeys, Slow Down and See the World, which was released just last month.
Featuring over 200 inspirational entries, Unforgettable Journeys is our brand new celebration of slow travel and taking the scenic route. The team here at DK Eyewitness have handpicked the world's best adventures, from cruising around Alaska and Antarctica to train journeys in Zambia and Zimbabwe. The book is organised by types of transport, so whether you're an avid hiker, cyclist or driver, or love to be on the water or the rails, we've got you covered. So how did you guys find working on the book, to start us off?
Big question. Becky, how about you?
Because I was editing this title, I started a bit before Shafiq, although I did consult with you when we were compiling the list. So we started by choosing our favourite journeys in-house. So we talked, all of the editorial team talked about the most amazing journeys that they'd made or ones that they wanted to make. Mm-hmm. And then I talked to destination experts. So for South America and India, I talked to Shafiq about which journeys he thought we should include, and then talked to editors in our US office and writers in Africa about where they think. And then we ended up with a ginormous list and had to cut it down to, I think the final number is 239, which was really challenging. So that's where I started with it. And then I commissioned Shafiq, and you wrote quite a few entries.
Yes, I've lost count of exactly how many I wrote, but it was from a writing point of view, it was such a fun project to be part of. It just allowed me to cherry pick from some of my favourite destinations, some of my favourite experiences, some of my favourite journeys, and allowed me to range from the Andes to the Himalayas, from Antarctica to almost to the Arctic. It would have been nicer if I'd actually got to the Arctic, but almost to the Arctic. Yeah. And particularly, I mean, I was doing a lot of, as you mentioned, Rebecca, we started work on it before coronavirus became a thing, but a lot of the writing and editing was done kind of at the start of lockdown, and kind of at that time it was really nice to, you know, escape for a little bit and do something kind of in a different location, something that took your mind away from things. So I got a lot more out of this project, I think, because of the wider context.
Sure.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of one of the things that makes this book almost perfect for this time, in a way, in terms of it allows people to both remember past journeys and also make future journeys and have that kind of hope and passion for travel. And I guess that's probably quite exciting to share that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I say, I mean, this is I took part in some of the selections for Latin America and for India, and obviously you become very proprietorial about your suggestions. You're very keen yes. to lobby and get them included. I mean, it's difficult picking out the ones that you want to put forward, you want to recommend, but it's lovely to share them with kind of a wider audience. And particularly, you know, there's some very famous entries. I write about the Pan American Highway, for example, perhaps mm-hmm. the most famous road trip on earth. But then also, you know, you get the chance to you know, really champion some places and share some places that people may not have come across or may not have heard about mm-hmm. before. So an example of that would be the Death Road in Bolivia, which is more appealing than its name would suggest.
I remember you advocated, and I'd never heard of it before, but you'd been to Canada and been kayaking with the beluga whales?
Oh, wow.
In the Churchill yes. River. And we included that because the way that you sold that to me, I instantly wanted to do it.
This is why Shafik's a great travel writer, because he's good at pitching, twisting our arms.
Twisting the arms of editors is really 90% of the job, if not more. But it's funny that you mentioned that that one, because it's actually I was actually doing that research trip roughly a year ago,
right.
Almost a year ago. And so Churchill, for anyone that doesn't know, is in the sub-Arctic. It's in Manitoba. There's no road access to the rest of Canada. Mm. You have to fly or take a train there. But every summer, it's known as the polar bear capital of the world because it's on a polar bear migration route. Roughly around this time of year, October, November, you'll have 900 or so polar bears moving through onto the ice to feed. And when I say moving through, I mean literally walking down the main street of this small town. So people really have had to find a way to live with polar bears there. But so Churchill is famous, obviously, for its polar bears, and that's a reason to visit in its own right. But during the summer, the Churchill River Basin, which leads into the Hudson Bay, has around 3,000 beluga whales that come to breed. There's so many opportunities to get out on the water, to take boat trips, to take Zodiac trips, or something that I did, which was to kayak with them. And beluga whales, if you've never come across them before, are quite small whales. They're bright white, and they're very playful, almost like dolphins. So they swim around you. One of the most memorable experiences was paddling into the centre of the river and having these ghostly white apparitions pass underneath the kayak. And you'd be trying to take a photo of them, trying to really soak up the experience, but they always managed to surprise you by poking out one side or the other. And on one occasion, one of them expelled from its blowhole a mist of spray into my face, which caught me by surprise, provoked lots of laughter amongst my fellow kayakers. And so, I mean, the guide described it as being sneezed on by a beluga, which is not an experience I expected to have, but
you didn't get COVID.
This was a nice story pre-COVID. Now obviously it has a slightly different connotation.
So we'll kind of explore a couple of I mean, that sounds amazing. We'll explore some of Shafik's adventures in a little bit. So in sort of today's episode, to celebrate the launch of the book, we'll be discussing the art of slow travel, what it looks like in today's world, and looking at those kind of adventures, the appetite for slow travel, and how COVID-19 has forced many to reassess their travel priorities, whether they want to get sneezed on by a beluga whale or not, and what future journeys might look like for years to come.
Yeah, so if you listen out, we've got some special monologues in between each of the segments where writers involved in Unforgettable Journeys will be reading excerpts from the book about their favourite journeys.
So in our first audio extract from the book, here's travel writer Sarah Hedley-Hymer's reading about the drive up Jebel Hafit.
In a series of dramatic tarmac twists, a smooth black asphalt ribbon laces up the jagged surface of Jebel Hafit, or Empty Mountain, on the UAE-Oman border. Regularly pressed by high-performance tyres, the road zigzagging up Jebel Hafit has co-starred in big budget movies, as well as Porsche and Lamborghini ad campaigns. Film fans make pilgrimages here, following in the tracks of Bollywood's Race and Hollywood's Six Underground, and supercar spotting is act one on this tarmac stage. The main attraction, however, is the curves. Some 60 bends from exhilarating hairpins to swift sweepers must be navigated on the 12-kilometre, 7-mile drive to the top of Abu Dhabi's highest peak. In just 20 minutes, the road climbs 1,240 metres, 4,070 feet, passing virile desert vegetation and Bronze Age beehive tombs along the way. At the summit, the panorama expands to sand-blurred horizons. Accessible by car, motorbike and even bicycle, the uppermost observation deck hosts an eclectic congregation of petrol heads, serious cyclists, leather-clad bikers, picnicking families and selfie takers, all worshipping the view. The facilities may be humble, a car park, play area, cafe and a scattering of wooden gazebos, but the vista is nothing short of humbling.
In this section, we're going to look at slow travel as a philosophy, the advantages of going slow, and we'll discuss some of Shafiq's favourite adventures. So to start with, Becky, why did you guys decide to do a book about slow travel and journeys at this point?
So when we first came up with the concept of this book, it was pre-COVID. So it was a reaction to the fast-paced sort of commuter culture. Before COVID, it seems like ages ago now, but you'd be able to book a flight and fly to wherever you wanted, really, yeah, for a weekend break.
Just imagine.
Yeah. So it was a reaction to that. And obviously that has a huge environmental impact, but we also believe that it's not very good for yourself. And when you actually slow down and reconnect with a place that you're traveling in, you actually have a holiday, if that makes more sense, rather than a whistle stop city break. And then we really wanted to focus on journeys that didn't involve so many planes. Yeah. Of course, it depends where you live, but for some of these journeys, you will have to fly unless you want to take a very long boat or train to get to the beginning. But we didn't want to have, I think recently people have been doing quite a lot of making a lot of journeys where you fly to somewhere in, let's say, like Hanoi in Vietnam, and then you'll be flying to Hue and Da Nang and then down to Ho Chi Minh City and making all of these journeys. And we just wanted to fly the flag for some of the more amazing ways that you can get around places. Yeah. So in Vietnam, you could go by motorcycle, you could use the train. And we believe that it's by traveling that way that you get off the tourist track and understand the real heart of a country.
Yeah. And also do your bit for the environment a lot of the time as well.
Exactly.
The book is split up into chapters where it's routes for cycling, walking, rowing, driving, taking the train, right? So you've got a really nice coverage of lots of different forms of transports and the best journeys for each of those ways of traveling.
Exactly. We do have, so in the I think we call the driving sections actually called by roads, because we include motorcycling adventures. Sure. I think there's the Trans-American Trail, yeah, which is across America on a motorcycle, and motorcycling around Vietnam. And we also have a tuk-tuk journey, I think, in Cambodia. And then we have a by water section, because we really didn't want to have, I mean, cruises are so bad for the environment. So we really wanted to focus on, having canoeing, kayaking, small boats. We have the Hurtigruten cruise, which is around Norway in a, and that's a boat that runs anyway, because it delivers the post to all the offshore islands. Yeah. So it's just about traveling more consciously environmentally.
Cool.
And travelling in ways that you wouldn't expect to necessarily travel. I mean, travelling on a Norwegian mail boat is quite out there, really. But I mean, something about this as well, and we'll maybe touch on kind of how COVID has impacted, the events of 2020 have impacted our attitude to travel. But it is lots of the transport means, kind of almost fortuitously, that people have been kind of, you know, almost engaging with for the first time this year in terms of exploring their own country. So, yes. Lots of people getting into cycling at the minute. Lots of people, kayak sales went nuts over the summer.
Yeah. Well, James, you went cycling around Devon a few weeks ago, didn't you?
I did go cycling. I took the Tarka Trail around Devon, which was brilliant. I also showed my cycling group the Death Road bit in Bolivia, which I think Shafiq wrote, and they were terrified. So yeah, we went on a very flat ride through Devon instead. But amazing to read about and really, really interesting. So yeah, and Shafiq, how about, you've been kind of writing about like far-flung adventures for quite a long time. How did you kind of get into that adventure travel? What was your first kind of entrance into it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing with travel writing is that no two people have exactly the same routine. My routine was that growing up, I always wanted to be a sports reporter. I always wanted to be a sports journalist and write about football for a living. After university, I was lucky enough to do that. I was a sports reporter for the Evening Standard. I wrote for lots of newspapers about sport. But I hadn't taken a gap year at that time. I'd been on holidays with my family, which had instilled a love of travel with me for the first time. Yeah. But essentially, I kind of, you know, midway, you know, through my work at the Standard, I kind of got itchy feet. I kind of had a real desire to travel. And so essentially that kind of got too much at one point. And I took a kind of an impromptu gap year. So I went to traveled around India, and then I traveled around Latin America. And when I was in Latin America, because then, as now, there's remarkably few people writing about the continent in English. I was able to write some news pieces, but also some of my first travel pieces. And I used guidebooks religiously while I was there.
Glad to hear.
I thought, this will be a good way to earn a living. Yeah. And so when I came back to the UK, when the money ran out, I tried my best to break into the industry, which took quite a lot of banging on the doors. Yeah. And I kind of wrote reams and reams of letters and emails and phone calls and so on, but eventually I managed to get my foot in the door, and then you guys have been able to kick me out since.
And Shafiq, where I'm thinking, did you grow up, have you always been in London?
Yeah, I've always been in London.
Do you think that was part of the reason why, you know, the idea of traveling was so appealing? Because London's wonderful, but there's something about being in a city that can maybe feel a bit exhausting, that idea of, and it's, you know, a city of cities, but was there something about exploring the world that kind of really, you know, that kind of went hand in hand with living in sort of quite a hectic city?
Absolutely. I mean, I've always lived in South London, other than the period when I lived in an even bigger city in Argentina, Buenos Aires. It was definitely, I mean, I love cities and I love city life. But I've always had, you know, exactly as you say, Lucy, a real desire to kind of get out to the countryside, get out to the wilderness, really, just as a contrast, because it's a different pace of life, just because you can, you know, see the horizon, to be honest. And I was lucky in that my family, my parents love travel. Then they really instilled a love of travel in my sister and me. Yeah. I mean, that's really what they spent their money on growing up.
That's great. I mean, that's a wonderful upbringing. I think my parents are the same. And it's exactly that. I think I find that, as much as I love being in London, there's something about kind of, you know, taking an adventure somewhere else. And whenever I think of you, I think of you writing really epic pieces and, you know, quite a sort of, as you say, wilderness, quite a wild writer, as well as obviously being a London and Buenos Aires pro.
Yeah, because Shafiq, you've covered how many continents? Like, I mean, you're one of the few writers I know who's been to Antarctica, which is one thing to say.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked on all seven continents.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which has been very, very fortunate to do so. And yeah, I mean, Antarctica was somewhere, I mean, I've always wanted to go to since, you know, when you ask people about this, I'm sure you get a very common reply, which is watching David Attenborough documentaries growing up about Antarctica, about the wildlife, about, you know, somewhere that's almost as different a landscape as you can possibly imagine on Earth. I'd always wanted to go. And that really carried through when I was, became a travel writer. I write a lot about Argentina, a lot about Chile, particularly Patagonia and Tierra del Fuego. And so I kind of got as far as I could get, kind of 1,000 kilometres, you know, from Ushuaia in Argentine Tierra del Fuego to Antarctica. But I only actually managed to get to Antarctica a couple of years ago. I went on a kind of relatively small cruise that went to the Falkland Islands, went to South Georgia. South Georgia, somewhere that's even less visited than Antarctica, and kind of incredible wildlife and incredible history there. And it was an incredibly, you know, mesmerising, really quite moving experience, actually, being in a landscape like Antarctica. And, you know, one of the things that you become, you know, which we're all aware of, the environmental impact that the things that are happening on Antarctica at the moment. Here you get to see it firsthand. You get to see penguins, colonies of penguins in locations where they wouldn't have survived 100 years ago. You get to walk, you know, I walked on a beach in South Georgia with a photographer that actually worked on some of the David Attenborough documentaries. And he'd been there in the 1980s. And he was saying, well, this beach, if you were here then, you'd be walking on a glacier. And then he directed my attention to the cliff, which was a kind of a couple of hundred meters away. And you could see how far the glacier had retreated to that point. Wow. So you really get a really deep insight into that. I mean, you also have a kind of an incredible insight, real respect for the creatures that can survive in this environment. I mean, it's a relatively short season for visiting Antarctica. I mean, actually, in a normal year, you'd be starting nowish and kind of running through to February, early March.
I hear the rates are pretty low there.
Yes. Touch wood.
Terrible wood. Joke. I'm sorry about that.
Dad joke.
But yeah, that time is really easy. That time is they run the cruises there because that's the easiest time for humans to visit. But the, you know, the penguins, these thousands of strong penguin colonies survive there the year round. The whales live there the year round, and it's kind of, yeah, you have a lot of admiration for them if you visit.
Wow. And Becky, you do fly the flag for DK Eyewitness a bit in terms of you do like to travel as well. How did you kind of first get into being a travel editor?
So similarly to Shafiq and Lucy, my parents both grew up abroad. So we were always traveling when I was little, just because they were used to it. So yeah, I just always went on quite a lot of far-flung trips. So we went to Venezuela when I was a teenager, because my mum lived there for a bit. We've done like yachting around the Greek islands, which is in the book as well. We always did quite sort of big trips, and I didn't realize how lucky I was, which I am. It's amazing to do all these journeys. And then I think the thing with travel is most people love it. It's something that we all love doing because you come out of your everyday life and you're in a different culture, and then you take those experiences home with you. So I just was like, when it came to finding a job, I was like, why don't I do something that I really love? So yeah, being a travel editor seemed to fit the bill.
Amazing. Would you agree with that, Lucy?
It definitely does. But also, it's hard when you're getting all these amazing submissions from all these writers who are having these wonderful adventures. And I love getting copy, but I'm also, it just fills me with envy. And it just means that you've always got this list as long as your arm of places that you want to go to. That's a definite sort of slight downside of the job. But you know, it is a great job because you do get to travel the world every day and talk to, you know, fascinating people like Shafiq, who just always have a great story to tell. So that's a good bit of the job.
It was torture on this one because, I mean, some of them, like the Orient Express, the Venice Simplon Orient Express, it's so hard and so expensive to get a ticket, but it just looks amazing. Yeah. And the same with all these sort of far-flung epic journeys. I was a real sucker for the train rides, actually, which I never thought I'd say, but I just loved them.
I was the same, Becky. I have to say, when I was looking through the book, it was the trains. I was exactly the same. I was quite surprised. I like a trip. There's something very romantic about a train, isn't there? But I'd love to kind of, rather than just hopping on the Eurostar, I'd love to actually do, you know, interrailing and sort of properly explore somewhere by train. It was sort of a surprise to me that chapter really, you know, tickled me.
I think it's quite a diverse way of travelling because you have the experiences, it sounds cliched, but you have the experiences inside the carriages and then outside as well. So some of the copy we got about talking to your train companions while you're going across Siberia, it just sounded like an amazing way to travel.
Makes the experience all the more special. Out of interest, Becky, how many writers did work on this book?
So I totted that up before we talked. I think it was 30 in all, was a lot.
30, that is a lot. That's a lot of, sorry to sound really dull, it's a lot of contracts and purchase orders.
It is. But that was the only way we could cover such huge amounts of ground, though. And because we had so many journeys, we want to make sure that we had people who knew what they were talking about.
And
you can actually feel that in the copy. You can tell that people have actually done the journeys. They're not just writing about things they've seen on TV.
And you said there was 231 journeys, was it? Or
it is. Sorry, I can hear clicking here. write it down. 239.
So you had a longer list to start with.
Yeah.
How many did you have in the beginning?
I think we had nearly 300, which was a lot. And then we had to. It was like doing a jigsaw puzzle, because of the design of the book. With DK books, it's so important that things are visually appealing as well as read really well. We needed to have a hierarchy of how the journeys are presented, so there's some that cover 4 pages and then others that only cover half a page, and we had to decide which ones would get which treatment, which was really hard.
It's a 3-tier system.
Yeah, but all of the journeys really in there are amazing. They really are the creme de la creme.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And finally, before we kind of move on, is there one sort of journey that you wrote about in the book that you'd like to talk to us about, Shafiq?
Yeah, I mean, some of the longer pieces that I wrote that Becky mentioned, I mean, there's a couple of Antarctica, which we touched on before, was an incredible one to write about because there's it's so diverse. There's so many different experiences to fit in. There's the fact that because the weather is so temperamental down there that no two cruises are ever the same. The cruise that I took it's kind of impossible to repeat. To put that in perspective, one of the places that we visited was a place that rather ominously called the Danger Islands. This place is very limited maps. The guide, one of the guides on my cruise, told me that more people have stood on the top of Everest than have seen these islands. And they were home to a super colony, in quotes, of Adélie penguins. I believe it was about 1.5 million penguins, which is incredibly noisy and, putting it delicately, rather pungent, should we say. But it was an incredible experience to kind of travel in. There's not many parts of the world that you can go to and you think, well, this is genuinely untouched by humankind. But that would definitely be one of them. Another journey that I really enjoyed writing about was the Pan American Highway, which, if you don't know, it's from Alaska to Ushuaia and Tierra del Fuego. An absolutely incredible journey. And I particularly like that because of a lot of the Central American and the Latin American parts of that I know well are some of my favourite landscapes on Earth. And it's so incredibly diverse. So you've got the Atacama Desert, for example, the driest non-polar desert on Earth. You've got the Avenue of Volcanoes in Ecuador. You've got Patagonia, which, you know, I think we've all needed a bit of wilderness, a bit of a taste of the wilderness over the last year or so. Patagonia is really the place to go to when travel there is possible again. So that was a really nice way to fit in lots of my favourite places into a single journey. And you mentioned the death road in Bolivia, which is much shorter by contrast. I mean, you can do it in about half a day or so. It goes down from La Paz, which is one of the highest cities on Earth, and it drops precipitously through the subtropical valleys of the Yungas region to a place to like a tropical resort town. And it's, you know, it earned the nickname the most dangerous road in the world because in the 90s, hundreds of people were dying in accidents. The road is incredibly narrow, about 3 meters wide in places, sheer drops on one side, waterfalls splashing across the road, kind of gravel under the tyres. So, but it's also incredibly spectacular. So it's a memorable experience, hair raising at times. But you'll be pleased you did it, and you will have earned a drink at the end of it.
I really like how the difficulty level for that is moderate in the book, which I mean, it's probably moderate if you're willing to, you know, if you're not afraid of heights. Or
yeah, why did you choose moderate for it, Shafiq?
Well. Interesting. I did have to weigh that up. I was thinking it from a cycling ability point of view. Mm-hmm. You need to be a competent cycler. You don't need to be an expert cycler. It's I forget the exact distance. It's roughly 40 miles. Mm. It's down. I mean, the route that the tour companies offer is downhill, thankfully. Yeah. So the actual cycle is relatively straightforward, but the psychological side of it, because you know, because it carries the name, the most dangerous road in the world. There's sheer drops. There's lots of distractions. So you need to concentrate on it, but you don't need to be an expert cycler in terms of your your fitness levels or your skills. I should say you do need to be acclimatized to the altitude. So you're going down from kind of near enough 4,000 meters. That's the one thing to bear in mind. But as long as you've got your mind right, you should be okay.
Cool. I'll see how my mind goes in the future. And it's one, and like a lot of these journeys, they're amazing to hear about. And then the part of the like fun of the book really is just imagining taking them and imagining them being there. That must be such a cool experience. Cool. So we'll move on to the next section now. That's really, really interesting.
We're now going to look at how the attitudes to slow travel may have changed during 2020. So, Shafiq, has sort of COVID and periods of lockdown, do you think, inspire people to be more adventurous around those frustrations around sort of being cooped up and not being able to travel?
I think the word unprecedented has been used to the point of cliche to describe the crisis that we're living through at the moment. But I think in all of our lifetimes, this is a seismic event, and it's only... it's understandable and right in many ways that it kind of causes us to, look at our lives, look at different aspects of our lives, our work, the way we're living. And I think that definitely translates into travel. I'm an optimist. I mean, I don't know exactly when travel will get back to some semblance of normality. But I think when we can travel more, things like slow travel will really, really come of age. I mean, I think certainly where I live in South London during this time of lockdown, I've really appreciated my community. I've really appreciated the local independently run shops and cafes and pubs. You know, I've really appreciated my community and kind of going out to buy supplies for neighbours who are shielding or unable to do so. And I'd hope that kind of attitude really translates into travel. I was on at a virtual conference on Latin American travel earlier this week, and they had some figures that said roughly 10% of people in Latin America depend directly or indirectly on tourism. And the vast majority of these are not associated with the the big chains, the big airlines or anything like that. They're working as guides or drivers, or they have a small guest house, or they work in a hostel, or they clean a restaurant or a bar. And what I hope, and what I'll certainly be doing more when I travel both for work and pleasure in the future, is making sure that I use my money as much as possible to support, you know, these small scale, independent people on the ground. You know, tourism is a huge, huge industry. You know, we have a lot of spending power, and we have an opportunity to use it for good. So I would hope that that's something that, that kind of carries through.
Yeah.
And I definitely think, you know, there'll be a greater desire to kind of, you know, get out into the wilderness to see some horizons. Yeah. I mean, we're all feeling cooped up and tramped and cramped at the moment. I think it's something we can all empathise with. So, I definitely think there'll be that kind of desire. So I think hopefully it's been a very difficult time for the travel industry, as in, you know, most aspects of society. But I think hopefully it's also an opportunity to improve things in the future.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have kind of been rethinking the way that they experience their own backyard and actually how that would impact on their travel in the future as well. And I think, to me, one of the major things that I've noticed about lockdown is how essential travel is for people's sort of well-being. Mm. And actually, we talked a little bit about Race Across the World in the UK, which was on TV a few months ago. And lots of people were kind of seeing parts of the world they've never experienced before there, seeing people like them go through it too. And actually, I think there is a real desire, not just to get back traveling again, but to do it better and bigger and really support local communities too. And Becky, has your kind of attitude to travel changed? Have you got any kind of big plans that you want to do, or are you going to try and do anything differently?
So I was planning this summer, I was hoping to go around Vietnam for 3 weeks, which I'd been to before. But I was really looking forward to, I hadn't been to Sapa, which is in the north. And I think we've got some walks around there in Unforgettable Journeys, and didn't get to do that. But instead went to Pembrokeshire and walked the coastal path and went to Skye. So drove through the Highlands, which two journeys which are also in the book, and did lots of walk around Skye. So in the short term, it made me appreciate the British Isles and how much we have here to explore. But it has meant that I definitely know that when we are able to travel again freely, I don't just want a city break. I want a 2 week minimum exploration of somewhere completely different.
Yeah. And I guess a bit like as James was just saying as well, that need to kind of properly sort of take a step back from the grind, the daily grind, and 2 weeks might allow you to do that a bit more, Becky.
Exactly. I think as well from working at home, I just feel like I've just been the same space completely for ages now. So I just want to be somewhere, completely different. No sign of a desk, no chairs or anything, and just enjoying it.
Yeah, because I think, and there's nothing wrong with this at all, but many people, myself included, go on holiday for comfort, and there's definitely still going to be a place for that kind of holiday in the future. But actually, you know, we've got nothing but comfort at the minute in terms of everyone's
home. Yeah.
Hopefully your home's comfortable. And actually that kind of willingness for challenge or adventure. And as you were saying, Becky, you were able to go to Skye and have some of that and have a journey in the UK. But yeah, I think that there's definitely an appetite to do some more. And how was that journey in Skye? Like, how did you find it?
It was amazing. We drove up, which took a long time from London to Skye. But because there's a bridge rather than a ferry, we thought it'd be pretty COVID-proof, which it was, which was good. And it was just, it's amazing up there. It's almost like, I've not been to Iceland, but it's how I imagine Iceland looks. Mm. And it just feels like a completely different country from England. Although I'd say the same is true for Wales in a way. We're just lucky to have all these different landscapes around us. So I definitely appreciated, I felt so lucky to do it. And it was actually quite a good opportunity to explore much more of the UK. Sure.
Yeah, it's that's what strikes me. It's I find that a lot of my kind of friends are doing things in the UK when previously they would have popped across to Spain or wherever. As you say, it's a nice way to explore our backyards because, yeah, we're so spoiled. We've just got so many, sort of from, you know, the sandy beaches of Cornwall right to the wilds of, you know, the Highlands. Like, I went to Yorkshire a few weeks ago. Yorkshire's beautiful. It's just we are very, very lucky to have so much on our doorsteps. And I guess, as you were saying, Shafiq, to then support local within the UK for now until we can support local sort of in more foreign climes.
And there are like quite a lot of these, as you mentioned, the journey that you took in Skye, Becky, is in the book, right?
I don't think we feature Skye itself. We've got the Hebridean Way, which you can sort of see at points, the Outer Hebrides. And we have a drive through the Highlands, which you actually do on the way to Skye. And we were really lucky because the weather was beautiful. So it was just amazing. It was actually I can understand why it's in our guide having done it, because it was just so, I don't think I'm one of these people who gets super excited about driving. And I just, every bend in the road, it was just stunning. The only bad point were the midges when he stops by a lock.
Of course. Yeah, what did you do about that? Did you have something to wear for the midges?
Yeah, I had a mosquito net, which is like a tight that you put over your head.
A balaclava.
Yeah, so in Skye they have a lot of everything. They have quite a few fairy-related things. They have fairy pools, and you could do wild swimming in them, which looked amazing. And lots of people were doing that, but there were just midges everywhere. And yeah, I had to put this tight over your head, and then you had a sort of a line of midges on your on your neck, but it was beautiful nonetheless. It was definitely worth it.
And Shafiq, have you managed to get out and about in the UK for any journeys?
Yeah, I mean I've been as stationary as, you know, I've been in 20 years this year, like lots of people. So I mean, about the only real trip I've had has been to East Sussex. I mean, I'm in Southeast London, so not a huge distance away. But it felt like a massive adventure, even though it's part of the world I know quite well. And and actually, in some ways, that was quite refreshing because, you know, it's very easy to take for granted your local surroundings, the UK more generally. The UK is somewhere that, you know, parts of Scotland, for example, Northern Ireland, I know very little about from a travel point of view. I mean, I know parts of, you know, I spent more time in the Atacama Desert than I have in the Scottish Highlands, for example. So the trip to East Sussex was incredibly exciting, even though it's familiar. And it was great to do some walks and kind of get out into the countryside. The other thing, because I mean, I do love cities as well, and it's, I've tried to use the kind of the time during lockdown to really kind of explore kind of my local surroundings and the wider part of South East London. I mean, it's quite green around here. Greenwich Park is nearby. Blackheath is nearby. But actually, I've tried to, you know, imagine I was on holiday. What would I do in my local neighbourhood? Which has definitely helped.
The attitude that a lot of people have to kind of, you know, exploring their own sort of towns and cities and really kind of, you know, treating it almost like it's a holiday or like they're, you know, finding new aspects of the city. We're working on a new series called Like a Local at DK at the minute. Well, Lucy is working, and Becky, I think, are both working on that series, and which is very much about seeing different sides of cities, really. And do you think this kind of, you know, this whole year we'll see, you know, even things like city breaks done differently, people wanting to go, you know, to the unseen, go local, or go to, you know, do something completely different to the rest of the crowd?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there was a particularly from a city break point of view, there was a trend towards that before COVID anyway, kind of to kind of go beyond the usual, the most famous kind of attractions in any place, and also really experience the city and to properly experience the city, to kind of really get a feel for it. You need to kind of go where the locals go, talk to the locals, do as they would do. So I do think that will come back. I mean, I think probably in the short term, for understandable reasons, people are going to be a bit wary about going into crowded places. People are going to want to kind of do more kind of things in the countryside. But I think the other thing is that this current time that we live in has really reinforced and kind of reminded us of the things that we love about cities: the sitting in a cafe, having a coffee, meeting our friends for a drink, going to a concert, seeing some comedy, that kind of thing. And I think, you know, in many ways, certainly from a personal point of view, these are some of the things that I miss the most. And that when it's safe to do so, I'm going to be desperate to do that, both in London and kind of in cities further afield.
Absolutely.
You're completely right. I've been feeling like that. I've been, you know, I did go and sit in a coffee shop and had a coffee on my own the other day, and it felt like incredibly indulgent. I was taking pictures of it and sending it to my mum. Like, normally I wouldn't have thought twice about going into a coffee shop and having a coffee, but you're right. There's sort of real, out of something quite grim, there's definite sort of positives and really wonderful things to hold on to, I guess, that hopefully will kind of all be much more appreciative and much more community focused. I'm really hopeful that when we do all travel, we will all be sort of wanting to go to those cute family run places and chatting to the chefs rather than, you know, the chain supermarket or whatever. I'm really hoping that's something that's good, something good out of COVID.
Our next reading from the book comes from travel writer Sophie Ibbotson, who wrote this fascinating piece about cycling the Silk Road.
There never was just one Silk Road. The term was dreamed up in the 19th century by a German geographer, Ferdinand von Richthofen, to describe the plethora of intercontinental trading routes crisscrossing Eurasia, linking the Mediterranean, Persia, Central Asia, and China with the Indian subcontinent. What von Richthofen did, unknowingly, was inspire generations of writers and travellers to look at the East through a romantic lens. Even now, the phrase Silk Road conjures up images of camel caravans with precious goods making their way across empty deserts, mosques and madrasas bejewelled with turquoise and lapis lazuli, and exotic bazaars where you can buy anything from a bust of Lenin to a magic lamp. Despite the numerous routes, the general consensus is that the Silk Road stretched between Venice and Xi'an. In places where the terrain was most difficult, it made sense to follow the path of least resistance, over natural passes and between oases. The most popular route, therefore, was the Central Asian Silk Road, and included what poet James Elroy Flecker termed the Golden Road to Samarkand. For the first time in its history, the journey through Uzbekistan, at the heart of the Silk Road, is easy. Some 86 nationalities can visit without a visa. There are direct flight connections across Europe, the Middle East and Asia, and you can even travel between the UNESCO World Heritage Sites by high-speed train. But as ancient Silk Road travellers found, there's a great pleasure to be had in making your way independently, at your own pace, between the dazzling cities. Driving along the tarmac-covered highways, which follow the same course as the ancient trading routes, you have the chance to stop wherever you fancy, to meet people, and to explore sites that have gone unchanged for centuries. In Navoi, for example, intricately decorated plaster and brickwork still adorn the facade of the Rabati Malik, a medieval caravanserai, or roadside inn, where Silk Road merchants and pilgrims would once have stopped to safely spend the night.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So what does the future of slow travel look like? So we're going to start by just asking Shafiq and Becky what 2021 looks like. We talked about the kind of uptake of interest in epic journeys, but how quickly do you think we're able to get back to that? I mean, obviously we're waiting for sort of vaccines and stuff until we get back to it. But, you know, let's say we have a vaccine. How long do you think it will take for people to start traveling again? Do you think it will be immediate or like tentatively?
I'd love to be able to give you a definitive answer there. But I mean, I think the only honest response really is, to be honest, we don't know at this stage. I mean, I think, again, looking at it optimistically, if there's progress on vaccine, I think particularly if there's more testing as well, would make a huge difference, particularly to travel to and from the UK. I think there probably will be a bit of a lag and people need to get more confident before they start to do travel. But, you know, I think travel is really hardwired in us. You know, I'm completely confident that the desire to travel hasn't gone away. People just need to feel more confident and for it actually to be safer for people to do so. So it will pick up. Hopefully that'll be in 2021. Maybe it'll be a bit longer than that. But yeah, the desire for travel and long travel and epic travel will definitely be there. I mean, I said earlier, I think, you know, these kind of seismic events makes us, you know, look at our lives and kind of, you know, think what's important. We've seen huge changes to the way we work and so on. So I think it'll be a reminder to anyone that if you've been, you know, thinking about, you know, cycling down the Carretera Austral in Chilean Patagonia, if you've been thinking of driving the Pan American Highway, if, God forbid, you've been thinking about cycling down the Death Road in Bolivia, there's no time to waste. You know, as soon as you can, do it.
Absolutely. Wise words.
I think it will be interesting to see what happens with the airline industry, because if we have fewer flights, maybe people will be forced to do these epic journeys just because you can't just go there over a weekend. You have to actually explore properly.
Yeah. People will maybe be more creative with what they're doing when they're out there.
Yeah. I definitely agree, though. I think this has taught us all that we need to seize the moment and do things that we've been putting off. And if you want to make an epic journey, then the time, just do it before it's too late.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know one of the journeys you have in the book, Becky, is sort of interrailing, which you've mentioned sort of one route that you can take, but that is actually a very practical way to potentially get across Europe for lots of UK travellers over the next couple of years. And that is a natural journey in itself. Like, you kind of described going to Skyway, you accidentally almost did two of the journeys in the book, really. You know, there's lots and lots of ways to have an adventure, and I think the appetite for that is still pretty huge. And so is kind of, would you say, like, thinking of kind of interrailing, is slow travel almost going to be a de facto way for people to get around and see the world in the next couple of years?
I think so. I think we both will want to. Climate change is such a huge factor of life. And it's been obvious that during COVID and isolation, the environment's been thriving from us not flying and all of these things. So I think when we are able to travel, we'll need to be more conscious of what we're doing and how often we're flying, but also we'll want to as well. And as you say, with interrailing, there's no reason why, if you want to, in the book, we've got lots of like cycle trips in Europe and walks in Europe. There's no reason why you can't make the journey to the start point a journey in itself and enjoy every moment of it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many journeys in the book that probably join together, actually, and you could do one straight into another. Yeah, although I wouldn't recommend trying all sort of 251, that would be. Cool. And Lucy, this question goes for you too. What kind of future journeys are you guys planning to take? Are there any from the book which have particularly inspired you, Becky?
I just keep coming back again and again. I think it was the same writer actually that wrote both of them, but the Silk Road, cycling across the Silk Road. I think we've got cycling, train and driving. Any of those I just really want to do. And then also the Trans-Siberian Railway. I just think Russia just really fascinates me. And again, it's a train. The train's got me.
Shafiq, yeah. How about you?
I think Rebecca's stolen my thunder, really, because the Silk Road, which I've been reading a bit about recently, is somewhere I've always wanted to go to. It's a part of the world that I haven't really travelled in at all. But yeah, would absolutely love to explore, and the Trans-Siberian Railroad as well. A bit closer to home. I mean, I've really enjoyed, you know, it might sound a bit funny given that I write a lot about Latin America, I write a lot about Asia, but you know, some of the journeys in Scotland, and particularly in the Highlands, and particularly to the islands, absolutely incredible. And so, you know, that might be a slightly more realistic next trip for me. But yeah, I'm absolutely very keen to do that, and also more train travel in Europe. I mean, at the start of the year, I mean, I've been, you know, I think like lots of us, trying to fly less for environmental reasons, yeah. And I was trying to piece my way to various places in Europe via train. And actually, it kind of, you know, as you started to plan the journey, it kind of just sparked off different ideas. You say, oh, well, I could travel via Cologne, and so I might as well stop off there. Yeah. And then I could, maybe, you know, head over to the Netherlands, or head over to Italy, or, you know, and it kind of, and really that's the kind of travel that I love, where it's not over planned, and that you can be spontaneous to a certain extent. You can get lost, you can, you know, kind of end up in places that you didn't expect, and kind of, you know, often those are the richest experiences. So so I'm looking forward to doing that as well. One other journey is in British Columbia in Canada, which is where I should be now if the year had taken a slightly different turn. So kind of heading really up to the north, to the Haida Gwaii Archipelago, and to the Great Bear Rainforest. Wow. As well, to some wildlife spotting. So I'm not sure if that'll all be next year, but over the years to come, that's what's on my radar.
Have you found some of the things that you've planned for this year, Shafiq, have been able to move them to next year, or
things have been tentatively moved? I mean, I think the trip to Canada, to take an example, hopefully that there'll be a possibility for that to be done next year, or potentially slightly further into the future. Other things, unfortunately, are kind of just completely on hold, whether it's because of travel restrictions or budgets or different priorities. And certainly personal trips or potential research trips that I had for articles, have been on ice. But, you know, one door closes, another one opens. And so it kind of, it does, you know, it might force us to be, from a travel writing point of view, a bit more creative about what we write about, where we write about, how we do the research. So, there will definitely be some travel, but even if we're not sure where it will be yet.
So a big, big thank you to Shafiq and Becky for joining us on the podcast today. This was such a wonderful, uplifting episode. Thank you, guys.
And for anyone who hasn't read the book yet, please do go out and get a copy. It's pretty
spectacular.
Pretty spectacular, yeah. And actually, if you want to hear more from Shafiq, he's got some articles going up on the BBC Travel website. Is that right, Shafiq?
Yeah, I've got a piece on Colombia and another piece on Argentina coming out over the next couple of months. And looking a bit further ahead, I'll have my first travel narrative book called Crossed Off the Map, which is about Bolivia, and that'll be out sometime next year.
Fantastic.
So exciting.
Very excited to read that. And thank you. Big thank you to Becky as well for pulling together what has been a marvellous book through all the challenges of 2020 as well. Oh.
It was a delight.
So thanks very much, guys, for talking to us, and see you soon.
Bye, guys.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
And of course, we couldn't let Shafiq leave without him reading one of his own pieces from the book. So here's his journey into Antarctica.
Hundreds of thousands of penguins huddling together against bitter, sub-zero temperatures. Looming icebergs the size of small countries drifting slowly by. Pods of whales breaking the surface of the water and raising their flukes to the sky. Great walls of snow that appear to have been sculpted by a surrealist. Travelling to Antarctica is perhaps the ultimate journey available on Earth. Modern cruises are very comfortable, but as you cross the choppy Southern Ocean to the seventh continent, it's easy to imagine yourselves in the snowshoes of great polar explorers like Amundsen, Scott and Shackleton. Although it's possible to travel to Antarctica from Australia, New Zealand and Chile, most apart from the remote Argentine city of Ushuaia, located in Tierra del Fuego, Ushuaia is just 620 miles, 1,000 kilometres north of the Antarctic Peninsula. From the port, ships travel along the Beagle Channel before making the two-day crossing of the Drake Passage, a notoriously rough stretch of ocean between Cape Horn, the southernmost tip of South America, and the South Shetland Islands, an archipelago that lies just north of the Antarctic Peninsula. Weather conditions in this part of the world are, to put it mildly, challenging and ever-changing. As a result, itineraries are prone to alteration at short notice, and no two cruises are ever quite the same. But whichever route the ship ends up sailing, the experience is mesmerising, even life-altering.
It's the journey, not the destination, so the saying goes. And what better way to see the world than by moving through it?
If you want to take an epic road trip through the Scottish Highlands, set off on a breathtaking bike ride through Bolland Street's Bull Fields, jump aboard the romantic Venice Sampan Orient Express, Unforgettable Journeys Slow Down and See the World is packed with over 200 once-in-a-lifetime adventures that will stay with you forever.
Get your copy now at whsmith.co.uk via the link in our bio, where you can enjoy 20% off or at all good retailers.
A huge thank you once again to Shafiq and Becky. That was amazing.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, so stunning. So many different journey ideas. And you can find out even more in the book.
And next week, we're going to Paris in the company of travel writer Eleanor Aldridge, which I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, it should be really, really fun.
Yeah, to
really,
Paris.
Really interesting as well. There's lots going on there. But yeah. Also, it'll be it's always a fascinating city.
Yes.
Cool. So thank you to Lucy. We'll see you again next time.
Thanks, James. See you next time in Paris.
See you then. Where to Go was produced by the team at DK Eyewitness, presented by Lucy Richards and James Atkinson. For more information about DK Eyewitness, follow us on social media at DK Eyewitness or visit dk.com/eyewitness.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.